And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge has ruled that spying by the NYPD on Muslim groups in New York City was perfectly legal, with immediate outcries of civil rights groups.
Kentucky proposes allowing released felons the right to vote after the U.S. Attorney General announces suggested reforms.
Protesters oppose a peace deal in Ukraine with the support of the U.S. and the EU.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 21st, 2014. I'm Ryan Katz.
And I'm Liam Delta. The Oregon Senate has approved a bill that will study the possibility of allowing voting by internet in the state of Oregon. The study must be completed by December 1st, including any estimated costs or savings and what would be needed to comply with federal election laws. While some states and the military have conducted online voting pilot programs, no state in the U.S. currently allows direct internet voting. At least 13 countries have tried online voting in some form, with Estonia and United Arab Emirates using it nationwide. Proponents of the bill believe Oregon could become a national pioneer, as it did with vote by mail. Senator Bruce Starr, the Republican from Hillsborough who sponsored the bill, said that a presentation on Estonia's e-voting system prompted his interest in online voting. Here's a clip of Senator Starr, followed by other discussion at the session.
Really, colleagues, this is a very simple bill. It's a quest for information, and that's all it is. It doesn't in any way, shape, or form predetermine the outcome of this study. We're asking the Secretary of State to do a scan of the information that's available and report to us the pros and the cons of internet voting. I had the opportunity to travel internationally and was in a country where they do this, and it piqued my interest, Madam President. And I don't believe that that asking questions and having the information provided to us as legislators is a bad thing. I recognize, Madam President, that there are folks that absolutely believe this is the worst thing ever. But at the end of the day, Madam President, if this bill passes and the governor signs it, the Secretary of State will do that scan. The public will be engaged in that conversation. And we will, next year, have the information and you know, we can decide whether to go forward or not. It's a simple bill. It doesn't cost any money. The Secretary of State said that they can accommodate this within their current budget. And I would urge my vote. Thank you, Madam President.
Right now, the National Security Administration has a record of every keystroke, every Google search, every phone call, every text, every tweet, every single method of communication that we have in our society that's electronically based. The one area that the National Security Administration has no access to is the sanctity of the secret ballot. And electronic voting would destroy that sanctity. In other words, you know, the question might be asked, if the NSA is collecting information on all other aspects of their lives, why wouldn't they want information on how you vote? So, Madam President, it's my intention to put the legislative intent on the record that this study is designed to assure Oregonians that we've looked clearly at all of the aspects of electronic voting, including the shortcomings of electronic voting. I'd also like to put on record the legislative intent was to include the most vigorous critics of electronic voting in the study group so that Oregonians are fully informed. I will point out that some of our skeptics, the most vigorous skeptics, are the people that are responsible for the best outcomes in democracy. So, Madam President, I'm proud to support this bill, because I believe it's the way Oregonians can inform themselves not only on the potential benefits of new technologies, but also all of the ways in which new technologies can fail and be subverted. I will point out, as the most obvious evidence of failure and subversion of the electronic system, is the fact that the Secretary of State's website has been hacked by unknown hackers, is not online, has been compromised, and cannot currently be used. So no system in our society is safe, and the most important system of our society would be that by which we express our franchise under the Constitution, our vote, our right to have a vote that is by secret ballot. Thank you, Madam President.
That was a discussion from the Oregon Senate on a bill to study online voting in Oregon. The bill will now go to the Oregon House for a vote.
The Kentucky State Legislature is headed toward passing an historic bill that would give released felons the right to vote. Kentucky is currently one of 10 states that refuses to allow released felons the right to vote. On the other end of the spectrum is Oregon, which allows people convicted of a felony to vote once they've served their time in prison. Maine and Vermont go even further, allowing prisoners to vote even while they are serving time in prison. The ban on voting in most states translates to more than 5.5 million people in the United States who are disenfranchised. Many of these people are disenfranchised for life, with no chance to get their voting rights back. Felony convictions are far more frequent for African American men, even though multiple studies show that actual crime rates are evenly spread across the racial spectrum. In states such as Kentucky and Florida, this means almost one quarter of African American men of voting age are not allowed to vote. This disenfranchisement means that these former felons feel less connected and involved with their communities, leading to more crime. Kentucky legislators say that they are trying to reverse a trend of disenfranchisement that often ends up disproportionately impacting African Americans.
The vast majority of economic growth in Oregon between 2009 and 2011 went to the state's top 1%, according to a report on income inequality issued earlier this week by the Economic Policy Institute. The increasingly unequal states of America takes a look at the flow of economic gain on a state-by-state basis. Oregon is listed number 36. Since 1979, 80% of Oregon's economic growth has gone to the most affluent. At a national level, the report finds inequality returned to levels not seen since the 1920s. The methodology used in the study mirrored that of a similar report issued in 2012 entitled Pulling Apart. That study concluded that while the average low-wage workers' earnings increased by 2%, Oregon's high-end incomes increased at four times the rate from the late 90s to the mid-2000s.
Detroit officials laid out a plan today to avoid the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. The plan calls for slashing pensions by one-third for all but fire and police retirees, who will receive a 10% reduction. It also repays bondholders just $1 of every $5 owed to them by the city. City union leaders and retirees reacted to the plan with alarm, saying it would inflict undue pain on current and former city workers who are not responsible for the city's dire fiscal problems. One 67-year-old retired librarian said she would lose more than $400 of her $1,400 a month pension. She and others say they oppose the deal, which they claim is outrageously unfair. Although public worker pensions are protected from cuts under the Michigan Constitution, a December court ruling said that bankruptcy trumps those protections. That ruling leaves pensions vulnerable to be cut like any other financial obligation of the city. If that ruling stands, public workers across the country could also see their pensions cut to try to lower a city's financial debt. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight features an interview with Marie Daniels about common thinking errors as we navigate through life and its vicissitudes. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. This weekend's weather will be partly sunny on Saturday and mostly cloudy on Sunday with a slight chance of rain. Highs will be in the low 50s and lows in the mid-30s. Today, in 1848, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels published the Communist Manifesto. Malcolm X was assassinated today in 1965 by members of the Nation of Islam. And on this date in 1975, White House aides H.R. Haddleman and John Ehrlichman were sentenced to prison. The quote of the day is provided by Carl Sagan. If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
It's 5:16. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Who says the economy is down and that consumers aren't willing to spend in order to stimulate new economic growth? The problem with gloomy economists and skittish policymakers is that they don't know where to look for signs that boom times are back, baby. For example, take auto sales. Yeah, overall they're putzing along at a moderate to low pace, but open your eyes, people. Do you not see that Maserati sales were up 55% last year? Or that Rolls-Royce, Lamborghini, Porsche, and Bentley also produced double-digit increases? Listen to Matt Lavin, a Cleveland high roller who told the New York Times that he bought 3 Mercedes last year, one for $237,000, another for $165,000, and an auxiliary $97,000 number for his wife. Extravagant? It's all a matter of perspective. I look at it as I don't have a boat, Matt explains. There you go. Economics is all about having a positive attitude. So, with a booming stock market, high-tech wealth bubbling like crazy, and Fortune 500 CEOs making big bales of hay while the sun shines, what's not to like about America's economic future? An automotive lifestyle consultant told The Times, luxury is not a dirty word anymore. Now, isn't that a telling insight? You see, when Wall Street crashed 6 years ago, then got bailed out by Washington while the middle class sank, many of your 1%ers and higher got squeamish about living the luxurious life they deserve. But that's not the American way. Hey, if you've got it, flaunt it. This is Jim Hightower saying, surely we can all see the social value of top-end buyers who are willing to step up and make big-ticket purchases again. By leading the consumer charge, these bold luxury buyers are providing a role model that your lower classes need to do their own part in reviving America's economy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The Southern Environmental Law Center has won a lawsuit against the federal government that will reinforce environmental protections against open-pit coal mines. Protections were in place until 2008, when a last-minute move by the Bush administration relaxed the laws governing where coal companies could pile their tailings. KBOO reporter Keegan Herron spoke with Deborah Murray with the SELC for more.
Why was the 2008 ruling and subsequent relaxation of environmental protections deemed invalid by the recent court ruling?
The court ruled in favor of our client, National Parks Conservation Association, on our claims under the Endangered Species Act. The court found, as we had alleged in our complaint, that the Office of Surface Mining had failed to consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on potential impacts to endangered species before adopting the 2008 rule. And that reason is also important to our clients. It was based the reasoning was based on a 1996 biological opinion between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Office of Surface Mining, in which the Fish and Wildlife Service, and this was back in 1996, issued a very short opinion that said, if surface mining operations are conducted according to the regulatory program under the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, there will be no jeopardy to any species listed now or in the future. The Office of Surface Mining, in the case of the rule, relied on this 1996 biological opinion to conclude that it didn't need to consult, and she said, the court said, that such reliance was unlawful because of the significant new scientific information that has been developed since 1996 that shows the devastating impacts from mountaintop mining removal.
What are some of the endangered species that are under protection?
I can speak best to the endangered species in Tennessee. Our client, National Parks Conservation Association, was particularly concerned about the impacts on the Big South Fork National River and Recreation Area in Tennessee. This park is downstream from coal mining, surface coal mining, and the evidence in the record shows that there are endangered mussel species as well as certain endangered fish species that are endangered in part as a result of surface coal mining.
Does this ruling just affect the Appalachian Mountains, or is it a nationwide rule?
It is a nationwide rule, but I would say that the most significant impacts are in the Central Appalachian Mountains because of the nature of mining there, with mountaintop removal mining. In essence, you know, the tops of the mountain is blasted off to get out the underlying coal, and then because the debris that's left over swells, you can't put it all back on the mountain. And in the narrow valleys of Central Appalachia, what has typically happened is that it gets dumped into the valley below. And given the topography there, that means the valley below typically contains headwater streams. So the 2008 rule completely eliminated buffer zones for practices such as this dumping of soil, rubble, and debris, so that it wasn't even subject to any protection. And her remedy, of course, is to set aside the 2008 rule and reinstate the former rule, which on its face is a very good and strong rule, but unfortunately over the years has been virtually ignored by regulators. So that's another problem that we have to confront. But it is a good rule on its face. It's a significant victory for the waterways in Appalachia and the biological diversity and preservation of our streams.
I've been speaking with Deborah Murray of the Southern Environmental Law Center. This is Keegan Herron with KBOO News.
A nuclear waste storage facility near Carlsbad, New Mexico, will remain closed for at least the next 3 weeks after a radiation leak. An underground air monitoring alarm went off at the waste isolation pilot plant, indicating unsafe concentrations of radiation in the air. No one was exposed to radiation above or below ground, but it will be several weeks before workers can go into the underground facility to determine what caused the leak. Radiation levels were found to be higher than normal around the facility, but were determined to be safe for human health. The U.S. Department of Energy said this was the first time the radiation had had a leak, or this facility had had a leak.
A deal aimed at ending the violence in Ukraine began to show serious strains late today, just hours after it had been signed. Angry protesters shouted down opposition members of parliament who negotiated the accord, and a military leader threatened armed attacks if President Yanukovych, a firm ally of Russia, did not step down by early morning. Russia, which joined France, Germany, and Poland in mediating the settlement, introduced an ominous element of uncertainty by declining to sign the accord. A wide gulf has opened up between the opposition's political leadership and a street movement that has radicalized and slipped far from the already tenuous control of politicians. There were angry chants in the protest encampment against the political opposition leaders who signed the deal. Dmytro Yarosh, the leader of Right Sector, a coalition of hardline nationalist groups, reacted defiantly to news of the settlement, drawing cheers from the crowd, stating that Right Sector will not lay down arms as required by the agreement. Washington and other Western capitals cheered the accord, but Moscow complained that it had been largely negotiated by the Europeans and Ukrainians. The accord mandates early presidential elections by December, a swift return to a 2004 constitution that sharply limited the president's powers, and the establishment within 10 days of a coalition government. The parliament also moved to free former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, to grant blanket amnesty to all protesters and provide financial aid to the hundreds of wounded and families of the dead. At this time, it is difficult to know how much of the fury in the streets around Independence Square is a final burst of anger or a sign of yet more following violence to come.
Violent protests continue to hit Venezuela today. The government sent troops to the western province of Táchira. Protests began earlier this month when a rally was called to bring attention to Venezuela's homicide rate. It's the third highest in the world. Near the end of the march, some protesters broke off from the group to damage police vehicles and government buildings. Two of these protesters were shot and killed, inciting a string of riots across the country, challenging a range of issues, including high inflation and shortages of basic goods like sugar and toilet paper. Yesterday, President Nicolas Maduro sent 3,000 troops to the western city of San Cristobal. He claimed the troop deployment was meant to ease tensions and keep the peace. But the mayor of San Cristobal says the troops only disrupt peaceful protests and interfere with daily life. One of the complaints of the protesters is the multiple internet outages they've experienced since the protests began. Many of the protesters believe the government, which controls 90% of the country's internet traffic, has deliberately cut off internet access as part of an effort to suppress dissent.
A new study has found that wild bumblebee populations are in decline in Europe, South America, North America, and Asia. A study published in the science journal Nature looked at the exchange of sickness and disease between bee populations. The study suggests that wild bumblebee decline may be linked to pathogens, disease, and parasites from commercial honeybee hives infecting natural bumblebee populations. It is possible that the bees are swapping disease by pollinating the same flowers. Other studies have linked the international honeybee decline to the use of certain pesticides known as neonicotinoids. Bumblebees are larger than honeybees and have smaller hive numbers, so losses can be more devastating. Wild bumblebees are integral to natural as well as commercial ecosystems and provide an estimated $3 billion worth of crop pollination each year.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the Afghan government announced today that it will begin an investigation into the execution of 23 Pakistani troops on Afghan soil. Afghan officials said that the Pakistani claims regarding the deaths of 23 Pakistan Frontier Corps personnel inside the Afghan territory could not be confirmed. But the officials added that they will investigate the claim that the soldiers were summarily executed by militia fighters. Across the border in Pakistan, a senior Afghan Taliban commander has been released from prison. Mansur Dadullah was allowed to reunite with his family today. He's the brother of Taliban leader Mullah Dadullah, who was killed during an operation by Afghan and coalition security forces in southern Afghanistan in 2007.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ariel Devros, Carl Fisher, Robin Ryan, and Ryan Katz. The producer is Keegan Heron. Our production engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local news stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ryan Katz.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KABU at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with Bradley Garrett, author of Explore Everything, Place Hacking the City, about reclaiming the city. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Dominic De La Sala, chief scientist with the Geos Institute. They'll talk about how doubling logging on BLM lands will elevate extinction rates to threaten wildlife, pollute streams with sediment runoff, and increase global warming pollution. At 11, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness. The topic is living with multiple sclerosis. And at 11:30, Leanne Kranz interviews Lydia Yuknovich of Mount Hood Community College about the Creative Writer Speaking Series. It brings authors, poets, filmmakers, and scholars to the MHCC campus for a series of interdisciplinary readings and discussions. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support in our recent winter membership drive. Your contribution keeps KABU on the air. We have a correction to the website address announced on Veteran Voices program this morning. The correct website to register for the Oregon Women Veteran Conference, which is happening in Eugene on March 28th and 29th, is OregonWomenVeteran.com. Early bird registration for the Hilton Hotel, where the conference will be held, is February 25th. Oscar Wilde said, "Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken." Good night, Ryan.
Good night, Liam.
Recently, the Portia Project hosted the Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School. Speakers covered many issues women face in prison and ideas for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline, February 24th at 6:30 p.m.
Community Radio is proud to host an open house to say goodbye to our interim station manager, Victoria Stoppiello,
and to welcome our new co-managers, Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw.
Please come to KABU on March 1st between noon and 4 p.m. for greeting and meeting, snacks, tours, and a general celebration of the start of our 46th year broadcasting.
KBOO is located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, a half block south of Burnside in Portland.
Again, this March 1st, noon to 4, here at your community radio station, KBOO. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, President Obama attended the North American Leaders Summit in Toluca, Mexico on February 19th to discuss NAFTA and the sprawling Trans-Pacific Partnership commercial treaty that the White House doesn't want you to know about. We'll talk with Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch about Toluca, NAFTA, and the TPP. Also this week, we read a lot about Iran's nuclear program in the newspaper. But what if most